Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes or Google Play and rate and review us while you're there. Today, I'm talking with Reason Foundation senior analyst Shikha Dalmia, who's also a columnist at The Week. She has a powerful new investigative story in the current issue of Reason magazine. It's called How Immigration's Crackdowns Screw Up Americans' Lives, and it packs a real wallop. Shikha traveled to Arizona to look at how increased enforcement of laws against illegal or undocumented immigrants are making life tougher, not just for them, but for those of us who were born here or are naturalized citizens or have full authorization via green cards to live and work in the U.S. Shikha, thanks for talking.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
All right. You write, and I'm quoting from the story, which is up at Reason.com. The war on immigration has taken a great toll on authorized aliens, its targets, but it is also badly affecting Americans themselves, its intended beneficiaries, those who think they can escape the crossfire because they are authorized, naturalized, or native-born, with American ancestors going back generations, are simply fooling themselves. Now, you begin your story with the tale of 40-year-old Lorenzo Palma, who is a U.S. citizen by birth. His grandparents or his grandfather came to the United States from Mexico, but he had no birth certificate since he was born in Mexico City but to an American. So he's an American citizen. He was serving time in prison for 5 years on an assault charge. He's about to get released, and then he's told by his jailers, that no, he's an illegal immigrant, and he spends two more years in jail before having his case cleared. So talk about how the Palma case is representative of one portion of the problem you're talking about in your story.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a very heartbreaking but very convoluted case. And it all began, you know, he was involved in an assault when he was in high school, and it was, you know, long story. And he, you know, paid his debt to society. He served 5 years in prison for that. And then the day before that he was going to be released, he got an ICE detainer put on him. And he was told by the jail authorities that, hey, you're not going to let you go. In fact, ICE is going to pick you up and take you to Huntsville in Texas. And he was just completely taken aback by that. He didn't know what was going on. And, you know, long story short, it turned out that ICE had somehow, because ICE has a habit of combing prisons to see who is illegal and who is of legal resident status, and they determined, just because his name happened to be Lorenzo Palma and they were confused, they decided he was an illegal alien. Now, the problem with him was that his mother actually, when gave birth to him, she went to Mexico to deliver him because she wanted to be near her family. Now, his grandfather was a U.S. citizen, had lived in America for a long time, but Lorenzo himself did not have a birth certificate. So he had to take a very, very convoluted route to prove that he was an American citizen. And he kept telling the immigration judge that, hey, I'm an American citizen, I shouldn't be here, because it is actually illegal for ICE to detain, much less deport, American citizens. But the judge would hear none of it. And he actually got extremely lucky. I mean, and this is typical for these immigration courts. Let me just mention one more thing. In 1996, under the Clinton administration, when Congress, you know, passed the reformed Immigration Nationalization Act, one of the things that it did was, in its zeal for what is expedited removal, which Trump wants to double down on, it basically told immigration authorities that, hey, if you get somebody in your, in your dragnet, and they are claiming they are an American citizen, they are no longer entitled to a judicial hearing. You can just do an administrative hearing and decide what you want to do with them. So essentially what that means is that if you get caught in the immigration bureaucracy, as Lorenzo did, you really have no due process rights left. You don't have any, you know, because immigration is a civil, not a criminal matter. So you're not entitled to an attorney. You're not entitled to a full court hearing. You're not entitled to examine your witnesses. Essentially, what the judges do is they hear these mass hearings with like 20 allegedly illegal aliens, and they rubber stamp the decision or the recommendations of the ICE attorney.
Wow. And in the story, you point out that in 2010 alone, that there were 4,000 or over 4,000 U.S. citizens who were detained or deported as aliens, and that between 2003 and 2010, about 20,000 Americans suffered the same fate. And you talked to one person who specializes in this kind of law, that at any given time, 1% of the inmates who are in immigration detention are American citizens. So, you know, this isn't hundreds of millions of people, but it is thousands and tens of thousands of people.
It's tens of thousands. Yeah. Right. And this is a conservative estimate, right? Because as Jacqueline Stevens is the professor, who you were referring to, she's at Northwestern and she runs a clinic where this is what she does. She tries and keep tabs on American citizens who are in detention or have been deported. And what she told me was that, you know, ICE or DHS, Department of Homeland Security, doesn't actually keep any data about, who it is detaining and deporting. It just has, this grab bag of information. And she, along with a couple of, other immigrant groups, they decided that in Southwest Arizona, they would just go through all the records of ICE and everybody they had in its detention and see what happened to each case. And what they realized was that that was one part of it. The other part that she did was she called pro bono attorneys, immigration attorneys, and ask them, how many people do you have in your caseload who are claiming to be American citizens? And based on this, she calculated that at any given time, 1% of the detained population is American citizen. Now, this is a very, very conservative estimate, because the only way you know that these people were American citizens was when they were determined to be American citizens. If you are an American citizen, but you can't be determined to be an American citizen and you are deported, there's no way of knowing. I mean, so there may be tens of thousands of Americans who've actually been deported, never to be heard from again, but, there's nothing they can do about it. She actually tracked down people in Mexico, American citizens in Mexico, which in what she called was a surreal reversal, that they were basically stateless citizens. They had been stripped of their American citizenship, but they were not Mexican citizens, and they were trying to eke out a living as day laborers in Mexico.
In order to show American citizenship, I mean, I guess you would need a birth certificate, a Social Security card, or a passport, something along those lines, a driver's license.
Social Security cards and driver's licenses are not proof of anything, right? I mean, driver's licenses, if you have an H-1B, you can get it as with Social Security card as well. The only thing you can show is, a birth certificate or your parents' birth certificate. Now, because he didn't have a birth certificate and his, mother actually did not have a birth certificate, the only document that they had in their, in their possession was his grandfather's birth certificate. But the complication over there was that even though they showed the grandfather's birth certificate, he also had to show that his grandfather had lived in the country for 5 years before he turned 17 for Lorenzo himself to have, a claim to citizenship.
Okay.
And just imagine this, like, this is a poor man, doesn't have a lot of resources. He actually didn't even have the money to call his mother, and request these documents. He cannot afford a lawyer. And he is stuck in, he's stuck in detention trying to get this paperwork. And he just happened to get extremely lucky that his case was moved from the docket of this one judge who was extremely unsympathetic to him and cases like him to one who actually was sympathetic and who took his claim of citizenship seriously. And he, saw that he doesn't have an accent, right? Which means that you know, he's lived in the United States all his life, and he's kind of giving some compelling biographical details that need further investigation. And it so happened that Jacqueline Stevens was actually in the court that day when this guy's case came up. And the judge asked her, hey, will you help him? And she put him in touch with a pro bono attorney. And then 2 years after he was in detention, he got all his paperwork together and was released. But, you know, he came this close, and many people don't come that close, right? And the other thing that, you know, that often happens, and he actually, Lorenzo, when he was interviewed by various news organizations later on, he said, you know, these detention facilities are not pretty places. These are basically glorified prisons. I mean, the living conditions are horrendous. And you are cut away from your, you know, family. And a lot of people, including Lorenzo, they, you know, come this close to signing away their rights and saying, okay, please deport me. Because then if they get deported, they at least can try and come back illegally and be reunited with their families. But if they are in detention trying to, you know, fight this case, they could be there indefinitely because, you know, they are not entitled to any kind of a day in court in any expeditious manner. So there are lots of people who actually just sign away their rights and become voluntarily illegal, even though they are American citizens.
It's like Kafka, who's wrote a novel about America, finally, his last masterwork, and it seems to be coming true. Now, part of this is, I mean, you talk about it in the story, and, you know, just a couple minutes ago, you mentioned Bill Clinton. It's really important to recognize, and you underscore this in the story, that this, the way people treat immigrants or the way presidents do is, you know, a bipartisan affair. Bill Clinton was very hostile in the Democratic Party in the late 90s to what they perceived as a problem with illegal immigrants. George W. Bush started deporting people, even though he was probably the most rhetorically positive towards immigrants, legal or illegal, since his father was in the White House. Barack Obama upped the number of deportations, and then Donald Trump obviously ran on this issue. But you've mentioned under Trump, you know, this, you know, all the gas has been poured out. Trump is lighting a match, and he's big on something called interior enforcement. Explain what interior enforcement is.
Yeah, so interior enforcement is basically a strategy to make the life of undocumented immigrants in this country so miserable that they would voluntarily self-deport. So it's a policy of like cleansing the interior of undocumented aliens. And any means necessary, nearly, almost, you know, whatever works. And this means, of course, going after them and, you know, trying to ferret them from wherever they are hiding. But it also means going, and this is the part of the story that I was highlighting, but it also means going after any American who may have come in contact with them or may have helped them, which means it means going after businesses.
Right. You know, this is especially – yeah, you travel to Arizona to look at how interior enforcement – which is also, you know, I mean, it's anywhere in the country. So the idea is that, you know, recognizing that the border is porous and, you know, the typical number that gets bruited about is about 40% of people come into the country legally and then simply overstay a tourist visa, a student visa, or a work visa. And, you know, now Trump is talking about taking the fight to everywhere where these people go, especially employers, target employers that knowingly or maybe semi-knowingly hire illegals. And, you know, what's amazing is you talk about how when we're talking about the workforce, 11% of U.S. restaurant and bar employees are undocumented. You know, in major cities, 30 to 40% of all restaurant workers are undocumented, you write. So, you know, that this is going to have a major impact if it's successful beyond just hassling people, if it actually cleanses the country of illegal workers. We're looking at a lot of businesses shutting down. And you talked to a guy named Jason Levesque, a 46-year-old free market conservative, again, based in Arizona, who was audited by ICE, Immigration and Control Enforcement, which found half of his 3,000 employees at various kind of restaurants and fast food joints were suspect. So what happened to Jason?
Yeah. So just to back up for a second. So, you know, the George Bush's weapon of choice going, you know, was doing something called workplace raids, which is that, you know, ICE SWAT teams would descend upon various factories and what have you and start just hauling illegal immigrants from there.
Anybody, so this would be, know, they would come in and they would say, like, your papers, please.
Yeah.
And if you didn't have
right.
it, then
and
you get
if
put.
You have them,
yeah.
Right. And so that was what George W. Bush did. Now, Barack Obama and liberals don't like going after poor, you know, Mexican, Hispanic, you know, people for all the obvious reasons, right? It's bad. It's bad optics and it is bad publicity. It doesn't play well with your constituencies and what have you. So they developed something called audit raids. Audit raids, well, they didn't develop it, but they kind of deployed this tool very, very generously. And basically what audit raids, and that's what Jason Levesque got caught in, is that, you know, they send their inspectors, and instead of doing a raid on your employees, they just start pouring into your books. They start going through your I-9 forms and, you know, all your paperwork about your employees to look for discrepancies and to see, you know, if the people who you say are legal are legal. So, you know, in Jason Levesque's case, they didn't, you know, they started auditing his books and they identified. Now, Jason Levesque owned about 80 Hardee's and Carl's Jr.'s, you know, restaurants across the country. And they flagged 2,000 people in his employ and said, hey, we are suspicious about these people. Please clarify who they are.
What is the grounds? Like, are they looking at the names of people and then are they looking at their Social Security or employer identification
yeah.
numbers, things like that?
Yeah, things like that, Social Security numbers matching with names, you know, to see if, you know, seeing if they have been paid properly, you know, all kinds of forensic tools that they use. And so Jason was given 3 days to clarify the status of 3,000 people. And this, I mean, you know, and he's not a small businessman, but he's not a big corporation either. So it, you know, it took a big toll on him, right? He said in direct and indirect costs, it cost him like $10 million to put all this information together. And then after that, like for about a year, he doesn't hear anything from ICE at all. You know, they don't say one thing or another. And the uncertainty is terrible because, you know, what does he do? Should he move forward with his expansion plans? He was in the, you know, expanding his chain and, you know, what have you. After 10 months, they tell him that about 1,200 of these employees are actually, you know, not legal. Now, what was, and I say in my piece, this was both infuriating and devastating to Levesque. It was infuriating because many of these people had actually cleared E-Verify. They had been cleared by the federal database as legal, but this database was so riddled with errors that these people turned out to be undocumented.
And you point to in your story, you mention a report that the federal government commissioned in 2009 that found that about over half of unauthorized workers who were submitted to E-Verify for this study were found to be authorized to work. So you
yes,
could actually
right.
go through the process and you send the people's names in through E-Verify, it comes back, yeah, they're legal to work and they're illegal to work and you're still in trouble.
You're still in trouble. And so you get no so-called amnesty, you know, from the government's own screw-ups, right? And then, and the second thing was that, you know, these people had, he was, you know, absolutely devastated because as he told me, you know, some of these people he had known since they were like, you know, young. They had started they had joined the company, you know, straight out of high school and they had, you know, moved up in the company and, you know, they were settled over here. They have children over here. They have American spouses over here. And there was no way for him to even ever suspect that they were undocumented. These were friends of his. And to have to fire all these people and replace them with novices was, you know, it was just too much for him. He, you know, he tried to make it work and he finally decided he was going to file for bankruptcy.
So that's
what he did.
Making America great, right? Is chasing after somebody who has a bunch of fast food franchises and is both employing people and serving customers and he gets hounded out of business, essentially.
Right. I mean, yeah, you know, they're shutting down American businesses to save American jobs. I mean, the whole insanity of it is, you know, kind of mind-boggling there.
There's another guy that you talk about who, and again, you know, one of the great things about this story is that, you know, and this is not directed at Yushik, it's more at me and the journalistic brethren, but you actually got out of your, you know, your comfort zone. You go down to Arizona and you actually talk to people. One of the people that you talked with is a guy named Bert Frimmel, a 43-year-old restaurateur, and he had two locations in the Phoenix area and restaurants called Uncle Sam's or something, and they're very patriotic. They serve wings and salads and burgers, you know, typical American food. And he and his partner, or his general manager, were charged with criminal acts for hiring illegals under two state Arizona laws. Talk about what happened to Frimmel and how this looks at a slightly different, you know, aspect of how strident enforcement of immigration laws is actually hurting Americans and citizens and business owners here. What happened to Bert?
So, you know, for all the rotten stuff that both the Bush and the Obama administrations did when it came to employers and undocumented workers, the one thing that they didn't do was go after them on criminal charges, right? Or not most of the time. They these were all civil suits or civil action against these employers, including Levesque. This is what is different in Arizona. Arizona, you know, everybody knows the 2014 SB 1070, your papers, please law, you know, which in addition to demanding, you know, your papers whenever some law enforcement officer decides he wants to see them, there were many anti-businesses, business provisions in that law. But before that, actually, in 2007, Arizona had passed, you know, the proto SB 1070, which was LAWA, which is called the Legal Employer Sanction Law. Basically, this law made it a criminal offense to have undocumented workers in your employ. If you were caught twice having illegal immigrants, basically, you know, they would invoke something called the business death penalty provision and revoke your license. And so Arpaio, Joe Arpaio, that notorious Maricopa County sheriff, this was kind of like a bonanza for him, right, these two laws. And he first used these laws to launch, you know, just raids of area businesses, restaurants, car washes, you know, dry cleaning facilities. And, you know, over a period of like 6 months, it was like a real reign of terror under Arpaio, where, you know, he would send his squad and they would, you know, haul away people. And then he would debrief these people, these illegal immigrants, and ask them about the employment practices. And he would offer them what are called like snitch visas. He would work with ICE and say, hey, if you rat out this employer who was employing you, I will, you know, we will maybe make you legal. And so Brett Frimmel, you know, so Brett Frimmel's establishment, as you point out, was raided. And Brett Frimmel, you know, the irony with him is he was actually a big Arpaio supporter. I mean, his business, his restaurant was called Uncle Sam's. His father started this restaurant. It is just like a real piece of Americana. I mean, if you go to the restaurant, you know, there are two statues of Uncle Sam at the door and, you know, with like this big neon sign saying, we want you, you know, like a real throwback to World War II, you know, American imagery. And the local Republican club would hold its, you know, monthly meetings at this restaurant because it was, you know, it was the kind of place they'd feel comfortable in. Anyway, Brett Frimmel's organization, his restaurant gets targeted by Arpaio's raid. Then, meanwhile, the Obama administration actually approached Frimmel asking him if they will cooperate against Arpaio because they had an investigation going on. Arpaio got wind of this and decided he was going to use the criminal laws against Frimmel and basically shut him down. So he concocted this entire case against Frimmel, just completely fabricated, pretended that the people whom he had, the illegal immigrants whom he had caught in Frimmel's employ, had told him that he was making them sign blank forms and that he would fill out with fake social security numbers and that he was running a human smuggling racket and what have you. And so his manager and Frimmel, their homes were raided, their restaurants were raided, and they were arrested. And because Frimmel's customer base is so pro-American, you know, like what they call patriots in Arizona, they are patriots, they all sort of stopped coming to this, you know, to this restaurant. And he claims that, you know, his restaurant, from being the most popular eating place in the Phoenix area, became completely deserted. Eventually, the judge realized that the entire case, the arrest warrants, everything was completely fabricated and threw out the charges. But now Frimmel has actually sued, Marisopa County and Arpaio for civil damages. But, I mean, it shows you the potential for the kinds of things that can happen to employers if you arm law enforcement with these kinds of tools.
Wow. Okay. So now there's a final kind of vignette or scene that you said in the piece, which again is up at reason.com. And it's about what's going on within 100 miles of the U.S. border. It's like all the way around the country. You know, if you draw like a thick line that counts for 100 miles from the border inwards, which the Supreme Court has basically ruled is part of the border, so that governments or law enforcement have wide power to stop and detain people and ask stuff. And you note in this story in passing that almost 2/3 of people in the country live within 100 miles of a border. So it's basically everybody, or it's 2/3 of people. You visited a town, and I'm going to mispronounce it, in Arizona called Aravaca, a small town that's within 100 miles. It's an unincorporated town of a few hundred people. And what did you find there, and how is this insistence on cracking down on illegal immigration, how is it playing in Aravaca?
So Aravaca was just a fascinating little, part of America, which, you know, if you don't look for it, you wouldn't imagine that such a place actually exists. To back up on the 100-mile zone, like, as you said, you know, 2/3 of Americans live within this 100-mile constitution-free zone, as the ACLU calls it. All of Michigan, by the way, where I live, is in this 100-mile zone. But in the northern half of the country, which borders Canada, there's not much activity going on. Basically, you know, in this 100-mile zone, the Supreme Court said that that Border Patrol can set up checkpoints anywhere it wants, and basically gave it the same powers to stop and search Americans that they have at ports of entry. So, you know, you can be asked to produce your papers, you can be searched, you know, anything, you know, that border patrol authorities want. And so this is kind of what has happened in Aravaca, which is on the southern half, right? I mean, it's an hour south of Tucson, and it is just on the border of 23 miles from Mexico. It's a really beautiful part of the country. You know, it's got forests, it's got ravines, it's got canyons. And it's been settled by 700 mostly white people. And these are retired cops. They are aging hippies. You know, just just like a real motley crew. And Border Patrol, about 10 years ago, decided that they were going to set this checkpoint over there. It is about 25 miles into the Aravaca, outside of Aravaca, and it basically means that any time this town, which has nothing much, it's got one little restaurant, it's got a grocery store, it doesn't have any hospitals, it doesn't even have a police station, any time that a resident, say, wants to take their children to the school or to the dentist or what have you, they actually have to first go through this checkpoint. Now, you know, there are checkpoints at other places too, you know, on highways and what have you. Those are, you know, those are less troublesome. But this one, because, you know, it's right outside this town, has become like a real menace for people. It has become, you know, like a font of petty bureaucratic tyranny, because, you know, these border patrol officials, they can tyrannize population, and they do. And it doesn't matter whether they are Hispanic or they are white, they just treat the border, the townspeople extremely poorly. Now, in theory, when the Supreme Court, you know, issued that 100-mile constitution-free zone ruling, it said that if you are an American citizen, they have to let you go. You know, they can't really ask you any more questions, except if they have reasonable suspicion. And what has happened in this town is practically anything can become a reasonable suspicion. So people told me that if you are driving, say, a sedan, because, you know, that they can't peer into automatically, the Border Patrol people can't peer into, if you're driving a sedan instead of a pickup, that's reasonable suspicion.
Because you might be smuggling. You might be smuggling
people. You might
people
be smuggling.
In
so, yeah,
trunk.
You may
yeah.
have... Yeah, you may have either drugs or you may have stuffed some illegals in your trunk. If you have heavy camping equipment, that can be cause for suspicion. You know, if you don't make eye contact with the Border Patrol agent when he says, hi, good morning, you know, that's a reasonable suspicion. If you speak too much and you're too mouthy with them, that's reasonable suspicion. And, you know, so basically this Border Patrol checkpoint has become, you know, just a daily source of harassment. And they have actually protested. The residents have been protesting to get this border checkpoint removed. They have tried, they actually put up a little patrol station not far from where the checkpoint is, because the Hispanics who go in and out are obviously, you know, if you're a Hispanic, that's reasonable suspicion. You are a drug trafficker and a human smuggler. And, you know, so they were monitoring the incident, and, you know, it's like the racial profiling is just kind of like, you know, off the charts. And so they have been trying every which way to get this border checkpoint removed, and they can't. And it's just stuck over there. And it was supposed to be a temporary thing, and that was 10 years ago. Now it's just become a permanent fixture, and they deal with it literally every day. As one of them put it, it is like, you know, living in West Bank and traveling to Israel every
wow.
day. It's that,
so
that kind of an
now,
experience.
You know, part of it, you know, the backdrop of the story, or kind of like the pretext of the story is, you know, all of this is for what as well? I mean, you point out that in the story that Mexican immigration coming across the Mexican border peaked by most accounts in 2008, and that it had to do with, you know, that with the exception of super totalitarian governments, it's very hard to control a border when people are coming here as economic, you know, for economic opportunity. And when the opportunities are good, they come. When they're not so good, they go away. But, you know, what do we gain? You know, do we gain anything by, you know, getting rid of illegal immigrants? Because, you know, at the Hardee's that, that are employing illegals rather than – is that work that Americans would do? I mean, what is the purported gain that we get by getting rid of people?
It's a very good question, and I really don't have a great answer to it. I think, you know, it is – first of all, it is some existential anxiety that America is in the grip of post-9/11. This big fear that if we don't enforce the border in the maximum possible way, you know, terrorists are going to come in and drug smugglers are going to come in and, you know, what have you. And so this, somehow there's this false comfort we get that if we enforce the border and patrol it very thoroughly, we can protect ourselves. You know, from some of these harms. I mean, and it doesn't work, right? I mean, because though even when you have border patrol agents, they are eminently corruptible, and that's one of the big problems, actually, that you know, Department of Homeland Security constantly faces. That border patrol agents get bought out by drug smugglers. It's you know, the U.S. government does not have enough money to pay these people to make it, you know, more lucrative than just being bribed by drug smugglers. So there is, you know, there is nothing we can do. We can't, you know, like creating like sort of this fortress and walling ourselves in doesn't work, but yet it gives us some kind of comfort that we are doing something.
Well,
I think that's,
you know, you touched on, I mean, you know, by talking about it, it's almost kind of an existential anxiety about life in America after 9/11 in particular. What else drives anti-immigrant animus? It's because it's not just terrorism. In your case, I mean, and you and I obviously agree. I think most people who write for Reason, and certainly many people who read it, understand, you know, like we're not so worried about the economic anxiety that, you know, I mean, data shows routinely that immigrants, whether they're legal and actually especially illegal, you know, they go to places with low unemployment and with burgeoning economies because, you know, they're going there for work. They're not going there to hang out. You don't see a lot of immigrants, you know, in upper Minnesota or something like that. They go to where the work is. And they don't take jobs that Americans don't want, all of that kind of stuff. But, you know, so, you know, is it just a misunderstanding that we're not going to be saved from terrorists? We're not going to be saved from, you know, people working for less money? You know, what do you think is driving anti-immigrant animus these days?
So, right. I mean, so the economic case against immigration is enormously weak, right, as you, for all the reasons that you just pointed out, that they, you know, don't go to places where they compete with Americans, right? I mean, they're substitutes. They're not substitutes for Americans. They are complements for
Americans. Right, and they're really kind of substitutes for machines more than anything.
Right, and, you know, if we are going to worry about American jobs, then we really need to worry more about robots and what have you than you know, Mexicans. But, you know, so that, but that said, I think you and I both know that the free market case for trade and immigration is extremely counterintuitive, right? I mean, people just see that the world has finite resources, it has finite jobs, and it's a dog-eat-dog world. If you get a job, that means I don't get a job. And it's very hard to kind of like push against that, no matter how false that is. But usually, you know, what's strange about the current nativist or the anti-immigration moment that we are facing right now is that the economy is doing pretty well. Right? I mean, and we are at full employment right now, and immigration flows from Mexico are zero. Net immigration flows are kind of zero. And yet, you know, we are kind of in this grip of this anti-immigration fervor. So I think I don't take the economic case all that seriously. I think at root also is just a general, you know, kind of tribalistic mentality. It is that America is a club and we want to, you know, have the privilege of controlling who we want to come and who we don't want to come.
Well, let me ask you about that. So Mexicans, and it's bizarre in America's kind of immigration history, for a long time, Mexicans or people from Latin America, people from the New World were not subject to any kind of origin, you know, national origin quota. There was a lot of freedom to move back and forth across the Mexican border. Obviously, that stopped generations ago. What does it mean that, you know, as you noted, there's no net immigration from Mexico anymore when you swap out people coming here versus people leaving? China and India are actually the big sources. Will they suffer from the same kind of tribalism, do you think, of kind of anti-immigrant? Because similar to Mexicans, particularly kind of mestizos, you know, they look different than, you know, a typical white American or a black American for that matter. Do you think they'll face the same or they'll raise the same kind of anxiety, or are they easier to swallow somehow?
Right. I mean, you know, the first bout of anti-immigrant sentiment that this country experienced was against the Chinese, right? I mean,
right.
The Chinese
mm-hmm.
Exclusion Act in the 19th century.
It's amazing, by the way, if I could just stop for a second, that, you know, the name of the law that kept – that essentially barred Chinese from coming here and certainly from starting families and owning property, all sorts of stuff, was simply called the Chinese Exclusion Act. And there was – I mean, it's a horrible you know, kind of moment. And when you look back at the legislative history, you know, it was not the only thing you can say about it is that they were not politically correct. They used no euphemisms to explain why.
Right. They were pretty open about their racism. Right. Yeah. We just don't want to get run over by yellow hordes was essentially the reason. And you know, as you pointed out, that the national origins quota system, when it was done away in 1965, and it actually, you know, opened the door to Asian immigrants for the first time. One of the reasons that at that time Ted Kennedy gave was, hey, listen, because we are, you know, the 1965 Act, it basically, you know, the emphasis was on family reunification. So if you have family already in the country, you would be, you know, you would have a bigger ability to bring family members from the other parts of the world. And because it was so European till then, the idea was that, hey, you know, there'll be more Europeans coming in because they have family ties with Europe.
Yeah, and they're and you're Asian, bringing grandma or whatever over.
Yeah. Or whatever, right. And that was fine because then we are getting Europeans and they share our cultural, you know, makeup and our racial makeup, and that's good. And Asians, because they don't have family ties, you know, they will be, you know, it'll all automatically, you know, they'll be left out. It didn't work out that way, right? Because after 1965, actually, there was a big wave of Asian immigrants from China, from India, from Philippines, and that continued, you know, that's been continuing to some extent, especially from China and India, because that's what the high-skilled, you know, they are the ones providing high-skilled workers. So now there is a backlash against them, right? Because you see Indian people, you know, like me, walking around in malls wearing saris and dots on their head, and they just look weird. And you know,
and you're taking good. You're taking your kids and are taking slots at competitive colleges. University of California system, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah. And we own the freaking spelling bee, right? I mean, Indians cannot lose the spelling bee. I mean, if they tried,
it might be good if they flubbed it. I realize it'll be hard, you know, to tell a kid to take a dive.
I wish they would. Yeah. Hey, you know, it's hell of a burden, and you, my son will testify to that, to be part of this freaking model minority, right? Everyone thinks you are some kind of a genius when it comes to spelling and let me tell you, my son does not spell well at all.
I was going to say, as the grandson of Irish and Italian people, I've never had to worry about the model minority.
So
do you think that Indians and Chinese will have an easier time of it than Mexicans, though, or perhaps as Italians and Jews and Poles and whatnot did in the early 20th century?
So I was going to say this. So, you know, now in some senses, Chinese and Indians, when they come to America, they are far better assimilated than when my parents' generation came over here, right? Because they watch Friends in India. They are up to, you know, speed on every Hollywood offering. And they speak English well. They know the latest American slang better than I do, my nieces and nephews in India. And so they come and they, you know, they fit right in. They don't face that kind of like a cultural barrier that even I faced when I came over here, just because America is better known around the world. But on the other hand, because they are dominating, you know, the upper echelons, right? I mean, Indians are the richest minority in the country. They face a backlash. It's kind of more akin to the Jews. Because they are doing so well, the backlash now is, I think, from the upper crust in America. It's not so much like a lower socioeconomic phenomenon. It is more that, hey, you know, why are they coming to all these preppy schools and, you know, doing well? You know, they are taking, they are getting into the Ivy League, and, you know, and so there is that backlash, I think, against Indians and Chinese that the Jews face, and it is not coming from the lower segments of society. So I think that's what's going to happen to them. I just wrote this piece. You know, there is also this revival of this idea that we want sort of some kind of cultural and ethnic purity in America, that, you know, there is this idea simmering in among conservatives that there is nothing wrong with wanting to associate with people, you know, whom you have a comfort level with, who share your background and who share your, you know, the way you look and what you eat.
But,
and I get that point. I get
but,
that point.
But you
I
know what? That I mean, just to push on that, you know, that point is so anachronistic because it includes suddenly you have a bunch of white people, and many of the people, many of the conservatives making that argument are Jewish or Italian or Irish or Polish. And, you know, in 1920, they weren't part of that discussion. They couldn't be because – and it's not that they were necessarily considered, you know, black or Asian or something, but it's like, come on. They, you know, they weren't assimilated. And it seems to me to pretend, okay, well, now we have a comfort level with Jews because we know they're really not horned devils, and that Italians aren't, you know, monkeys who somehow learned how to button shirts all the way up to the top, especially when they're not wearing a tie, et cetera. I mean, it just – I mean, I find that so ahistorical to, you know, claim that, you know, somehow now we have a comfort level. What is different, though, and I'm very interested in your opinion of this. One of the things that happened, and it was partly because of immigration policy, but it was more so because of the Depression and World War II and the rebuilding of Europe, is that after World War II, you know, or from like about 1930 until 1970, until the 70s, really, there wasn't that much European immigration to America. And in 1970, it was about 5% of the population was foreign born. It was the low point in American history. And it's, you know, at that moment, that ethnic pride, including black power, but also, you know, Italian power, Polish power, you know, Irish as a positive identity, all of this stuff flowered. Do we need – I mean, are there times where we've had large waves of immigration for, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years where we were able to assimilate that and people were able to get to a cultural, you know, kind of comfort level without a timeout? Because that's one of the other things you hear from restrictionists is that, look, we need a timeout. You know, America can't digest all of these new people. What do you think of that? Is it you know, is that true? Like, do we need a timeout, or do we need a what is the framework that we need that wouldn't punish people, including Americans who are getting caught up in these immigration raids? You know, how do we assimilate people, or not assimilate people? How do we get comfortable with people when more and more keep coming?
Well, so yeah, I mean, that's exactly the argument we're hearing more and more from the right, that look, after in 1930, you know, we had a period of like, you know, mass immigration. Is there
that wonderful period of the Depression and World War II, where we, you know, we didn't have to worry about immigrants, at least.
Right. Yeah. And then 1930, we stopped this mass immigration. And then until 1965, we didn't open the, you know, the gates again. And look, all these, you know, various ethnicities, Italians and Irish, then they got time to assimilate. And so that's what we need now. We need to clamp down on all these Asians, Chinese and Indians, and give the ones who are already here time to assimilate. That's kind of like the argument you hear. And, you know, I think it's a good argument, again, if you think that you know, you want some kind of a homogeneous America, right? I mean, that you don't want this, you know, this mishmash, this cosmopolitan, you know, the ethos. You don't want diversity. You don't want mongrels. You just want people to come and kind of like, you know, melt into the big us. Then it's, you know, it's an argument. But if you look at how assimilation patterns are actually have happened in the last, you know, 40 years, there really is no problem with assimilation, right? I mean, if you look at even Hispanic statistics, as you have repeatedly pointed out, by the second generation, 90% of all Hispanics are speaking English. By the third generation, literally zero are, you know, speaking Spanish, and they are all speaking English. And, you know, and the rate of intermarriage is extremely high. And so there is really, you know, if you look at the stats, it's not a problem. But there is a problem when it comes to optics, because what happens is that if you have what they call ethnic replenishment, there is always a subset of new immigrants who are not fully assimilated. And people see that. So they see these unassimilated people that they keep, you know, coming across and not the, you know, the waves that have already assimilated. That's hard to see. And I think that is one of the things that is feeding the frenzy against immigrants right now. But, you know, as a social phenomenon goes, there's really no problem because rates of intermarriage are high. Crime rates are extremely low. Mobility, you know, income mobility within various immigrant groups is extremely high, higher than what it used to be before for literally every subgroup. So, you know, it's one of those problems that, you know, you can keep pointing the numbers to and you can keep pointing the evidence to, but the evidence of your senses is so much more powerful that people don't want to take that into account.
I can tell you, and I suspect, I mean, you're in Michigan. I'm talking to you from Ohio, from a small town in southwestern Ohio. And the real immigration problem is when immigrants stop coming, because it's, you know, that's a sign that you're in an economy that has calcified and is no longer functioning very well in a weird way, even though that seems to be the place where a lot of Americans, including a lot of, you know, coastal elites want, you know, they want a country that reminds them of the one they grew up in, which is I don't think has ever, that's never an ideal, really. And, you know, this talk about going back into the past, it's like straight out of The Great Gatsby. You end up, you know, face down in a swimming pool in Long Island. And I don't think anybody wants that. Let me ask you this as a final kind of topic. Is there, politically speaking, you know, and again, Donald Trump, he ran on an anti-immigrant, platform. That was, you know, the biggest thing. And you still hear this when people say, what does Donald Trump have to do to please his base? It's build the wall. He needs to be anti-immigrant, or at least needs to be talking that way. The Republican Party is chasing out people who are moderate or positive on immigration, people like Jeff Flake, the Arizona senator who is not standing for re-election. Is there any chance to believe that any immigration policy change is going to happen in the next couple of years, say before the next presidential election? And if so, is there any reason to believe that it wouldn't be terrible, that it wouldn't just double, triple, quadruple down on the harms done not just to immigrants but to Americans that you document in your recent feature?
Not really. I mean, I'm quite pessimistic about getting any kind of sensible immigration reform. I mean, not that there aren't efforts afoot. I mean, there are actually quite a few efforts afoot, to push sensible piecemeal legislation that doesn't, you know, try to do this whole comprehensive omnibus thing, which, you know, helps as many people as it mobilizes opponents against it. There is the Dreamer Act, which is a pretty clean bill to legalize, people who were brought to this country before they became, they were minors.
For a Christian country, that we visit the sins of the fathers and mothers against the children, it's heartbreaking, to be quite honest.
It is. I mean, and, you know, there is a chance that, you know, before Trump starts throwing them out in March, after their DACA protections expire, that we will get some, you know, very, very limited, you know, effort on that front. There is also some effort afoot to give some relief to a few targeted industries that are really suffering from immigration shortages, like, you know, the ag industry. So there is a bill. But I think the action for insofar as Trump is in power, is going to be on the administrative side, right? And that's all bad. I mean, that's all the emphasis on interior enforcement. It's ongoing defunding sanctuary cities. It's deporting people. It's going after employers.
He was supposedly going to deconstruct the administrative state, and he has done that to a certain degree. At the FDA, the EPA, Department of Education, the FCC, he's loosening some of the ridiculous regulations put in place by Obama.
But then he's amping it up elsewhere.
He's
ramping it up when it comes to immigration, and he's ramping it up when it comes to trade. And so, you know, that's, I think, where the action is going to be insofar as Trump is in office. That said, you know, I have been saying this for a while, but I seriously believe that what we are facing right now is the last gasp of nativism, because the West's future problem is not going to be too much immigration, not too many people coming to its shores, but too few. And so it is going to have to actually completely do a complete paradigm shift and start looking for ways to, like, court immigrants, like companies court workers on campuses and, you know, what have you. And the reason is that most of the time, the immigrants who have come to the West have come from countries that have undergone something called the demographic transition, which means that their fertility rates, infant mortality rates have dropped, but their fertility rates have not dropped. And so with the result that they have, like, the surplus of young people to, you know, send elsewhere to the world. Every country in the world, except for sub-Saharan Africa, has completed this demographic transition. I mean, China's, you know, one-child policy means that its workforce is going to be aging. India's fertility rates are actually just about at replacement now. So, you know, after, in about 20 years, the West's problem is going to be completely different. And at that point, you know, we will need a, you know, we'll need a way to talk about immigrants in a different way. And those are going to be such large demographic and sociological realities that, you know, nativism, I think, will not have a chance then.
Well,
but
let's hope not.
With it for now.
Yeah, let's hope not, because that's essentially where Japan finds itself, right, with a massively aging population and not enough young people to replenish the economy or even to serve. I mean, I guess it's good for, you know, the robot industry, but that's about it. Shika,
yeah,
ask just very quickly, when did you come to the United States, and what has your experience been, since you landed here to now? Do you feel like things are getting better or worse, or, just a quick kind of account, write the check. Like, are you still bullish on America, or do you think that it's going too far?
Well, so I came to this country in 1985, so I've been here a while. I was married at that time when I came to my then husband, who was Indian. Since then, I've gotten remarried to an American, and I've raised an American son who's, you know, just about as American as they come, doesn't speak Hindi, you know, my mother tongue. And America has been very good to me, and it's been very good to, you know, my family and my son. I mean, he's, you know, flourished in this country, and that's one of the reasons I came over here. I used to always say the Indian education system was so crap that, you know, I may have screwed up my son in 100 different ways, but one thing I did was I saved him from the Indian, you know, Indian education system. And I'm very proud of myself for that. And, you know, and so America has been, you know, I mean, on a human level, I've actually never really experienced racism or nativism one-on-one. I've, in America, and I sometimes feel that if I weren't doing the job that I was doing, which, you know, my job is to kind of look at politics and, you know, examine the political discourse and rhetoric, you know, I may perhaps would not sense the change of mood towards immigrants that's happening in America. That said, I really, you know, this discourse, and I lived through the 1995-96 spasm of anti-immigration fervor. And I really have to say the rhetoric then was not as bad as it is today. I mean, this is just about the worst I've ever seen. You know, things that are said about immigrants, you just didn't think you would hear in respectable company. I mean, there's even this whole idea that a homogeneous America is better than, multi-ethnic America is just, you know, this argument hasn't surfaced in like 30 years or 40 years, and we are hearing it again. So I do think it's a pretty bad moment right now, but I also am optimistic that, you know, we'll weather it, partly because of the realities, the demographic realities that I mentioned, but also, you know, partly because, you know, this country is just kind of like innately like good and decent, and it's, you know, it, just doesn't do things like that. And so I'm just on the whole optimistic that we
Well, I certainly I'm not sure I share your optimism, but I certainly hope that you're correct about that. We will leave it there. We have been talking with Reason Foundation senior analyst Shikha Dalmia, whose great investigative story about the reality of immigration and the enforcement, harder and harder enforcement of immigration laws is screwing up Americans. It's called How Immigration Crackdowns Screw Up Americans' Lives, and it's up at reason.com. Shikha, thanks so much for talking.
Thanks for having me, Nick. It was really fun.
This has been the Reason Podcast. Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes or Google Play and rate and review us while you're there.